This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Malaria is one of these diseases that you can make amazing progress against it, but as soon as you take your foot off the gas pedal, it comes roaring back.
That's Margaret Riley McConnell, Executive Director of Nothing But Nets. Details coming up.
Also, DRC officials are still standing firm in their refusal to attend a major donors conference organized by the UN. And reports indicate General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, has suffered a stroke and is now in a French hospital.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, as donors prepare to gather in Geneva tomorrow for a major aid conference organized by the UN to raise $1.7 billion for humanitarian needs in the DRC, the government of the Central African nation is standing firm on its refusal to attend or cooperate. VOA's Anita Powell has the story from Johannesburg.
The United Nations says more than 13 million people are now in dire need of humanitarian assistance in the sprawling Central African nation, which is full of mineral wealth, but substantially lacking in critical infrastructure and basic government services. And so, aid agencies say, it is crucial to intervene to alleviate crises in parts of the country that the UN has put on par with Syria and Yemen. The UN has declared three conflict-ridden regions in Congo, Kasai, Tanganyika, and South Kivu, as level 3 emergencies, the most severe category. The UN says more than 2 million children are at risk of dying from severe acute malnutrition. But the government has pushed back on the emergency classification, saying it was based on facts that are not real. Presidential adviser Patrick Nkanga told VOA the government disagrees with how the Geneva conference was organized and must safeguard national sovereignty.
La situation telle qu'elle est décrite, la RDC.
He says the organizers of the conference have characterized the situation in Congo in a way that deliberately tarnishes the country's image. He says the government's conditions for the conference were not met, and the entire basis for the conference, as it has been presented by the organizers, is not conducive to collaboration. The Catholic Church has spoken out against the government's boycott of the conference, with a top Kinshasa cardinal saying to his congregation last Sunday, "We can't refuse help when we have empty hands." Congo analyst Stephanie Walters of the Institute for Security Studies told VOA that there is more to this situation than meets the eye.
The context for this is, of course, the ongoing electoral crisis and the increasingly difficult relationship between the Kabila government and the international community about the electoral delays, about the crackdowns on political freedoms, about the strong security services' responses to protests, about the ban on political marches, and the entire repressive political context in which the country now finds itself.
President Joseph Kabila has stayed in office 2 years beyond the end of his elected mandate, as the country has repeatedly delayed elections, citing logistical issues. The government recently announced it would not accept any donor aid to help finance the poll, now slated for December. Officials said the assistance would amount to foreign meddling. With the presidential election coming, Walter says the government's rejection of the Geneva conference is self-defeating.
And what you've really done is you've put yourself out there and said, we don't want international support to help our population. It's a silly move, and I don't think it's going to win the government any points. Now, does that mean that the donors won't continue to give aid to the DRC? It doesn't mean that. But if you have a hostile government, they can, and then it can make it very difficult for those organizations to operate in the Congo.
VOA visited the troubled Kasai region last month, where half the children were malnourished even before the beginning of the 2016 conflict that was triggered when Kabila clung to power beyond his two-term limit. We met with families who were among the million residents who fled their homes, leaving behind their crops. And we spoke to a nurse, Marie-Louise Misenga, who worked in an overrun UNICEF-supported clinic that, on one particular day, was filled with desperate mothers and their malnourished babies, and asked her what one message she would want to give to the world. Here's her response. She says, if the international community brings us some support, it would make us happy and be a good help. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Aid agencies say the fight against malaria has saved millions of lives, but there are concerns about a possible resurgence. The biggest area of concern is Africa, home to 90% of the cases. Two major conferences are being held in Dakar starting Sunday and next week by the Commonwealth countries to look at the progress and the challenges. VOA's Paul Alexander spoke with Margaret O'Reilly McConnell, Executive Director of Nothing But Nets, a UN Foundation organization that aims to supply bed nets to the needy. She discusses the current situation.
The fight against malaria is at a critical crossroads. We've seen tremendous progress over the last 10 to 15 years. We talk about how investments in malaria have led to, you know, nearly 7 million lives being saved or deaths averted. We've seen tremendous reductions in mortality. So, for example, we've had a 71% reduction in deaths for children under 5 in Africa over the last 10 to 15 years. So amazing progress has been made. But what we've seen recently from the WHO's World Malaria Report in 2017 for the first time showed a stagnation in progress. We're starting to see, in some cases, overall, the biggest issue in terms of stagnation of progress really is a plateauing around funding and sort of political will, both from malaria endemic countries and from donor countries as well. We've seen those, we're, you know, only at about half of where we need to be in terms of funding for malaria, and it's just not enough. We're also seeing issues where countries are experiencing conflict. So, for example, in Venezuela or in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we're seeing progress have reversed and actually come back in greater levels. We also are seeing some elements of insecticide resistance. So all of these, there are, you know, a number of signs of there's still a lot of progress. More countries are closer to elimination than ever before, but we are at a critical juncture. So it's more important than ever that we sort of redouble our efforts, that we continue having the political will and the gumption to, you know, look towards a day where we can actually end malaria for good. There's some exciting targets that have been set forth by the WHO and by others in the malaria community to reach elimination in a number of countries, regions, and there actually is an eventual goal or a big ambitious goal of eradication by 2040.
So why does Africa remain the worst hit area?
So Africa is still about 90% of the malaria burden is in Africa, and that is largely because, well, it's for a number of reasons, actually. In part, it's because of the species of mosquito, the Anopheles, particularly the Anopheles gambiae, is the most efficient vector. It is the most fatal, sort of deadly strain of malaria, if you will. And Africa has, you know, what we call tremendous vectorial capacity, which is in part because of environmental reasons. It's also because of health system infrastructure capacity. So there are a number of reasons that malaria sort of has the greatest burden in Africa. Again, amazing progress has been made in many countries, but there are challenges. Like I mentioned, right now Nigeria actually has 30% of the global malaria burden is in Nigeria, and places like DRC and other countries that experience conflict, civil war, et cetera. You know, malaria is one of these diseases that you can make amazing progress against it, but as soon as you take your foot off the gas pedal, it comes roaring back.
Could we actually have a resurgence?
Yes. I mean, I think is a simple answer that, you know, malaria is a disease, it's a sensitive disease, the mosquito, the vector is very smart or adept, great at evolving, and has been a real challenge in terms of how to tackle. We've had tremendous tools like the insecticide-treated bed net that have, you know, the WHO reports that about 68% of reduction of malaria is because of the insecticide-treated bed net and the widespread distribution of bed nets. So, for example, in 2000, only 2% of people living in Africa had access to a bed net, and now that figure is about 53%.
So what would you anticipate that increased funding would be used for?
So I'd say with increased investment in malaria, I think it's a multi-pronged approach. It's going to require investments in existing tools in terms of ensuring that all families, all communities have access to prevention measures, such as insecticide-treated bed nets. With everything that people have gone through, as having to flee their homes, having to flee their loved ones, the last thing they should worry about is dying from a preventable, treatable disease and dying from a mosquito bite.
That was Margaret Riley McConnell, Executive Director, Nothing But Nets, speaking with our colleague, Paul Alexander.
International news reports say General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, has suffered a stroke and is now in a French hospital. However, his spokesman Ahmad al-Mazmari says Haftar is in good health. Even so, the reports raise questions about what happens in Libya if Haftar is not leading his force and not taking part in international efforts to stabilize the country. Rhiannon Smith is the managing editor of Libya Analysis in London. She explains to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi the possible ramifications on the Libyan political scene if General Haftar drops out.
Well, the first thing is, I think if Haftar were to drop out of the scene, there will definitely be a big impact. This will be a big event and could have really, really serious repercussions on the political scene in Libya. It could go one of two ways at this point. So I think the most likely scenario is actually it will make the conflict worse and the political situation worse. And that's because on the Haftar side and in the east of Libya, you're going to have a power vacuum and there's going to be a struggle for power within those different factions. And that's likely to create a great deal of instability, which will filter out to the rest of the country. On the other hand, Haftar himself as a person, as an individual, has been a big sticking point for many of the different militias in western Libya. And therefore, there is a possibility that if he leaves the scene, that actually that could remove a major obstacle to reconciliation and could actually smooth the way to political reconciliation sooner rather than later.
Haftar's camp is the main rival to the UN-backed government of National Accord. Is there any leader within his camp who could replace Haftar in challenging GNA?
Well, so within the sort of eastern camp, there's the Libyan National Army, which Haftar heads, and the House of Representatives, which is the sort of political body. And there are a number of different sort of rival factions, military and political, within that. I think kind of some obvious figures that could take the lead. One would be Abdul Razak al-Nazouri, who is currently Haftar's chief of staff for the sort of military government in eastern Libya. He has quite a lot of power and standing. He could be an obvious one. Another would be Waniz Bouhameda, who is the head of the SAIKA Special Forces. And they've actually had a few run-ins with Haftar recently and a lot of kind of human rights abuses, quite close links to some of the Salafist groups. So they are quite a powerful group, militarily powerful. And if they were to sort of come to the forefront, that could really change some of the dynamics in eastern Libya. The other one would be Aguila Saleh, who is the head of the HOR. As a political leader, he doesn't have so much weight with some of the military figures, but he's quite a strong tribal figure, and I think some of these tribal leaders may also try to gain power if Haftar were to step out of the frame.
Haftar relied heavily on military force to gain influence. Would his possible departure change the approach of his camp into political negotiations for a peaceful settlement?
That very much will depend which faction and which leadership really come to the forefront. A lot of the reason why Haftar has been going towards political negotiation recently, even though he's previously been against it, has been to do from pressure from external backers like Egypt and Saudi and others. If he's out of the picture, that will complicate things and they may take quite a long time to figure out who they want to back next, who's really coming to the forefront. So I think ultimately it probably makes political negotiation less likely in the short term because all of these groups in the East are going to be looking inwards and trying to decide who actually holds the balance of power in the East before they try and look out to the rest of Libya and trying to negotiate a solution for the whole of the country.
That was Rhiannon Smith, the managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis. She spoke with our colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Twenty past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The German aid agency HELP says armed men have kidnapped one of its workers in western Niger. The attackers were on four motorcycles that surrounded the man's vehicle about 18 miles from Ayoru as he was returning from a trip to the troubled Tel Aberi region. Four local workers for the aid agency were freed after being beaten up. Their vehicle was burned. There was no immediate claims of responsibility or demands for ransom.
In the Gambia, medical doctors have been on sit-down strike for over a month. Yesterday, the Association of Gambian Doctors Association met with government authorities to see if they could resolve the matter. The doctors are protesting recent allegations made by the health minister accusing them of stealing drugs from government health facilities. Reporter Pandaria Mbai reports.
The doctors' protest has virtually paralyzed Gambia's collapsed health sector. Efforts by the government to convince the striking doctors to resume work have failed. The doctors maintain they will not return to work unless Health Minister Safilo Cisse is fired. They are angry Cisse has accused doctors of stealing drugs from public hospitals to use in their private practices. The Association of Gambian Resident Doctors calls the minister's allegations unfounded. The doctors say the short supply of drugs in the country is the result of poor leadership at the Ministry of Health. They say since President Adama Barrow took office a year ago, medications have not been imported into the country. Dr. Ibrahim Abba is the president of the Resident Doctors Association.
What happens is, whether the doctors are on protest or not on protest, patient care in the Gambia has gone to the lowest it can be. This is because of the absence of basic things in the hospitals.
Bas says that many patients are dying after undergoing surgery because of a lack of painkiller drugs to help patients to handle pain after surgery.
In 3 months, 100 people died at the ICU. So those responsible for the death of those people, that death is on the heads of those people who were supposed to provide the doctors with what they need to save lives.
Both Vice President Fatoumata Diallo Tambajang and the head of the civil service, Habib Drame, have talked with the striking doctors, but have been unable to end the dispute. Demba Ali Jao is Gambia's information minister.
My message to them is to think about the negative effects of what they are doing. It's the ordinary Gambians, people who can't afford maybe to go to private clinics, who don't have the money to go to private clinics or see private doctors, who are going to suffer. And these are the downtrodden Gambians. So, whatever grievances they have, I think they should go around the table and discuss this issue rather than going on strike.
The Doctors Association's boss says he is optimistic that the government and the doctors will soon find a solution to the dispute. For VOA Africa, this is Pandaria Mbai reporting.
According to a new report by Amnesty International, state-sanctioned executions and death sentences decreased in 2017, including in sub-Saharan Africa. Chika Odua has the story from Dakar.
Amnesty International is careful to note the global decline in the use of the death penalty in 2017 was preceded by record highs in executions in 2015 and death sentences in 2016. Rights activists see the downturn as cause for hope, and Amnesty says sub-Saharan Africa is leading the trend.
It feels like there's a momentum in sub-Saharan Africa towards abolition, and that's partly because of public pressure around that. It's partly because judges, for some cases, can use more discretion.
Amnesty's West and Central Africa Deputy Director Steve Cockburn says countries in the region are eager to appear progressive. In 2017, Guinea became the 20th country in sub-Saharan Africa to abolish the death penalty for all crimes. Meanwhile, Kenya's Supreme Court abolished the mandatory death penalty for murder. Burkina Faso is drafting a new constitution that rights activists expect will outlaw the death penalty. The same goes for Gambia, following President Yahya Jammeh's ouster in 2016. Gambian human rights activist Babalé was once detained and tortured for his outspoken criticism of the Jammeh government's execution of prison inmates.
It's a great thing. I feel so much victorious. Look, here is something that I was fighting for 40-something years. It become real.
Amnesty says South Sudan and Somalia were the only countries in sub-Saharan Africa known to have carried out death sentences last year. Somalia had by far the most executions, 24, according to Amnesty. Somali activist Abdi Salam Adan told VOA the death penalty is needed to fight terrorism.
In a Somalia case, it happens when they suspect someone who is a member of Al-Shabaab terror group. They investigate and then they say, okay, as per the evidence, she's among those people who kill innocent Somali. They kill by shooting. Yes, that happens. But sometimes they have to kill because he has killed someone. And as per the Islamic law, if you kill, you have to be killed.
Nigeria leads the pack for death sentences in sub-Saharan Africa, with 621 death sentences handed down last year and more than 2,000 inmates on death row. But Nigeria has carried out no execution since 2016, when it executed three prisoners by hanging. Prison reform activist Sylvester Uha told VOA the Nigerian justice system is too corrupt to impose death sentences.
What we need to do is to invest in our youth, invest in education, invest in employment, invest in other ways of reducing crime, especially violent crime in our society. And this is what our country has paid to do over the years.
The Nigerian Prison Service told VOA that deepening democracy in Nigeria is why state governors are reluctant to actually sign death warrants. Instead, last year saw a few governors commute dozens of sentences to life imprisonment. Chika Odua for VOA News, Dakar.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
On the next edition of Press Conference USA, a conversation about Middle East politics. Alan Lapson, director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, analyzes Syria, Iraq, Iran, and the protests in Gaza, among other critical issues. That's Press Conference USA, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.